Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I have a new single that's been out maybe 10 days or so. For those of you who have not heard it, I will tell you that it was written and produced by a young man named Lionel Richie of the Commodores. And it's called Lady. Lady, I'm your knight in shining armor, and I love you. You have made me what I am. I am yours. My love, there's so many ways I want to say I love you. Let me hold you in my arms for evermore. You have gone. Made me whole. Forever, let me wake to see you each and every morning. Let me hear you whisper softly in my ear.
Okay, sorry about that silence there. That was Kenny Rogers He is an American singer, songwriter, photographer, record producer, actor, entrepreneur, and author, and a member of the Country Music Hall of Fame. He has been successful in country audiences, and he has charted more than 120 hit singles across various music genres, topped the country and pop album charts for more than 200 individual weeks in the United States alone, and has sold over 130 million records worldwide, making him one of the highest selling artists of all time. Many of you know him from The Gambler. He is from Houston, Texas. And he was also the narrator on the piece that I played on the Texas Rangers. Anyway, sorry about that little silence there. I had the mic muted and did not know it. I had one of them on the board, but I didn't have the mic on my headset. This is the second time I've used this headset. So, anyway, welcome to the Dragon's Lair. And again, tonight's show is The Importance of Knowing About Texas Continued, and most of you know what this show is about, or you wouldn't be listening to it. But if you, this is your first time you're hearing it, go to the Blog Talk Radio Show page for details. And also, too, I hope everybody saw the page that I did for the Texas music. What I did was, is I selected songs that were either about Texas or had something to do with Texas, regardless of where the artist was from. And on these shows, I've been trying to do mainly Texas artists, but that's really just not possible. It's so many people have come here and made Texas home that I've decided to expand it to basically people who are from here, people who have moved here, call it home, or have grown up here for a significant part of their youth, or lived here for a significant part of their adult life, whatever the case may be. For example, Steve Miller, his family moved here right before he started grade school, and he graduated high school here. And then after he got out of high school, he moved. But, you know, his significant part of his youth was here in Texas. That's just one example. So anyway, for the record, today is October 4th, 2013, on our screwed up Christian calendar. The sun is at 11 degrees Libra. Again, I have no personal website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that's magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe to my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee that I can get around to answering all of my emails, but I will read every one of them that are from my listeners. No calls tonight, as usual. So, what I'm going to do tonight, I finished off the last show several weeks ago, and a lot of things have happened since then, and most of you know that. And so there's a huge delay in this show following the last. So anyway, I had played a couple of pieces in that last show that were about Texas and gave some information about how Texas is today, or within reasons. It was, you know, maybe some of it was maybe 5 years old. But and this time around, I said I would play one on Dallas and one on Houston. And actually, that's Dallas-Fort Worth, not just Dallas. You can't really separate those two. They started out separately but grew together. But they are still really two different cities. But what I decided to do, based upon further thinking about the issue, is what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and play each one, one DFW and one for Houston. And then I'll take some notes while I'm listening and see if there's anything I need to add to it. And I have some lists from the other two shows. But on the next show that I do in this series, I'm going to go deeper into the demographics. You know, or at least some people anyway, people I consider to be not always critical thinkers, just look at a general statistic and come to a conclusion without looking any further and researching the details of that. And I think a lot of people in this movement do that. Not all, but some. And for whatever reason, they just don't think. I don't know what the reason is. Maybe it's because where they live, they can be in the next state in half an hour or 45 minutes or whatever. They don't live in some place like Texas, where if you want to go from one end to the other, it's a 2-day drive. You know, like here where I'm at, I can be in Louisiana in a little less than 2 hours. If I want to go to Oklahoma or Arkansas, it's going to take me about 6.5 hours, 7 hours. And if I want to get to Mexico, well, that's at least an 8-hour drive that way. So you get the idea. And you look at a statistic and you just don't always stop and think. But that will be for the next show. What I'm going to do before I play these pieces on DFW in Houston is I'm going to go to Wikipedia, and what I'm going to talk about next is the flag of Texas, and I will get into it more deeply in future shows. But a couple of people, being smart asses, I suppose, probably serious, thought that they poked fun at the Texas flag. Well, that's fine. You're entitled to your opinion. However, there are associations that actually do research on flags. One of them is the North American Vexillological Association. You can find it on Wikipedia. It says here it is an American and Canadian membership organization devoted to vexology, which is the scientific and scholarly study of flags. It was founded in 1967. The association is a charter member of the International Federal Vexillological Association and is among the highest vexillological organizations. Now, that's what Wikipedia says about it. Now, if you go to their website, there's a section in there called State and Provincial Flag Survey. This was done in 2001. And what they did was, everything in this category is the United States and Canada, whether it's a state or a territory or a province. They looked at all of their flags. They didn't look at the cities. You know, some cities have flags, but just the states and territories and provinces. And I'll read to you what it says. It says, in 2001, the North American Vexillological Association conducted a poll on its website, asking its members and the public their opinions of flag designs of the U.S. and Canada. Responses came in from 100 members and over 300 members of the public in 20 countries. Participants rated 72 flags on their design qualities rather than on political, historical, or geographical considerations. And on a scale of 0 to 10, where 10 was the best score, they were asked to rely on their personal sense of good flag design in rating the flags, which appeared on the webpage. They cast well over 29,000 individual votes. Association members favored strong, simple, distinctive flags, choosing New Mexico, Texas, and Quebec in first, second, and third place, all with scores above 8. They scorned the seal on a bedsheet design common to more than half of the United States state flags, forcefully relegating those flags to the bottom of the heap, with scores averaging less than 4. One flag drew far more attention than all others did. The members and the public both gave the new Georgia flag the lowest score, a 2.4 points, by the largest margin of any flag. Some even asked to give it negative points. They disparaged Georgia's flag as a scalawag, desolating, simply awful, hideous, and by far the ugliest. And that's from this website. I'm just reading what they're saying. Its complex design violates all the principles of good flag design, incorporating a seal, lettering, and a series of miniature historical flags in incorrect order, by the way. One person derided it as five flags under Georgia. Canadian flags fared significantly better than most U.S. flags, with an average score of 6 points versus five. Canada's provincial flags generally avoid seals and tend towards more simple designs. The state seal on a blue background design of so many U.S. state flags dates back to the 19th century, 19th century adoption of regimental flags to represent the states. They are relatively indistinguishable from each other at a distance, except perhaps Oregon's flag, which is the only one to have a different design on the back. And again, number one was New Mexico, number two was Texas, number three was Quebec, number four is Maryland, number five is Alaska. Now, if we go down to the bottom of the heap, we'll see that Georgia came in 72nd. And let me scroll back up. And, for example, the state of Wisconsin came in as number 65. Now, I tend to think that these people know what they're talking about. So, nevertheless, let me get on back to the studio here, and I'll play the one on DFW first, and then I will play the one on Houston second. And by the way, whenever I get ready to go over these demographics, I'm going to be dealing mainly with metropolitan areas because, you know, a city is just the definition of its corporate limits, but it's a metropolitan area, and that's what really ultimately matters. It functions as a whole. So anyway, let me play this one for you.
DFW, also known as the Metroplex, is a massive airport surrounded by Fort Worth in the west, Dallas in the east, and over 100 suburb cities. This isn't just a growth spurt. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex has consistently added more than 300 residents per day for the last 30 years. With a growing population of over 6.5 million, it's the fourth largest metro area in the country and the largest in the Texaplex. What is the Texaplex? It's the triangular region of Texas that comprises Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Austin. It's where 80% of the 24 million Texans live. Its economic growth, geographical location, natural resources, infrastructure, people, and even its weather have created a perfect storm of opportunity and growth that's completely outpacing the rest of the nation. Dallas-Fort Worth is built on innovation and the entrepreneurial spirit fostered since the area was founded in the mid-1800s. The first convenience store in the nation was opened in DFW in the 1920s. That one small store became the global corporation known as 7-Eleven. North Park Center was the first covered shopping mall in the country, today, DFW leads the nation with the most shopping centers per capita. The first drive-through bank was built in Dallas-Fort Worth. And resident Don Wetzel invented the ATM machine. The frozen margarita was invented by DFW restaurateur Mariano Martinez. Even Barney, the purple dinosaur, was born in the Metroplex. But no invention can match what came out of DFW in 1958. The first integrated circuit, what would one day become the microchip, was invented by Jack Kilby at Texas Instruments. He was just one of the Dallas-Fort Worth residents who changed our world forever. With this much entrepreneurial spirit and can-do attitude, it's no wonder that DFW is the fastest-growing metropolitan area in the nation, adding over 145,000 residents in the last year alone. With over 6.5 million residents, it's the fourth largest in the U.S., behind only New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago. That's more residents than 34 states. And the numbers keep rising. By 2030, the Metroplex is estimated to grow to 9 million residents. The DFW area encompasses 9,286 square miles, making it larger than Rhode Island and Connecticut. Combined. Dallas-Fort Worth means business. DFW was selected by Inc. magazine as one of the best metropolitan areas for entrepreneurs and is home to 25 Fortune 500 companies. There are over 145,000 businesses in the DFW area and more than 1,500 regional and corporate headquarters. 23 billionaires call the Metroplex home. Only three other cities in the world have more. The Metroplex's geographical location gives it a superior advantage. Its location in the central time zone extends the workday for companies doing business on both coasts. The Metroplex is known as the nation's largest inland port. It has the second largest number of freeway miles per capita in the nation. Within 24 hours, truck drivers can reach 37% of the nation's population. And in 48 hours, they can reach 93%. With no state income tax and no tax on goods in transit, it's no wonder DFW is such an important transportation hub of highways, railways, and airports. At almost 30 square miles, DFW International Airport has 5 terminals, 175 gates, 2 hotels, and is itself larger than Manhattan. It's the 3rd busiest in the world in terms of aircraft movement, and the 7th busiest for passenger traffic, transporting over 55 million passengers a year. It's so big that it employs a workforce of nearly 60,000, collectively paid a total salary of more than $7.6 billion. It even has its own 36-hole golf course. The Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex is a great place to live, learn, and have fun. Collectively, its private and public universities enroll over 297,000 students. It provides residents with state-of-the-art care at any of its 90 hospitals. The Metroplex is home to the 4th most valuable sports franchise in the world, the Dallas Cowboys. Only one other U.S. team even makes the top 5. For the sports fan, there is a home team in each of the major professional sports leagues. And Texas Motor Speedway seats over 190,000 racing fans. For golfers, DFW boasts over 100 courses to choose from. There are over 60 lakes and reservoirs within 100 miles of DFW. The State Fair of Texas, known for its famous fried treats, is the largest annual state fair in the nation. The Metroplex is home to more restaurants per capita than New York City. Both Dallas and Fort Worth are home to growing and well-respected arts districts, and the Metroplex is quickly becoming known as a film industry hotspot. Housing costs are significantly lower than other U.S. cities of its size. Forbes ranks DFW in the top 10 best cities to buy a home, and rates it as one of the nation's strongest housing markets. Take a look at a typical brand new home in the Metroplex. 3,500 square feet with 4 bedrooms, 3.5 bathrooms, a media room, and a modern kitchen with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances located in a suburb with exemplary rated schools, all for an amazingly affordable price. With this much growth and opportunity and one of the nation's most stable employment and housing markets, it's no wonder that Dallas-Fort Worth adds more than 300 residents per day and has for the last 30 years. A special thanks to Texas State Farm agents for underwriting this video.
Okay, that was Dallas. I'm going to play Houston next. And yeah, State Farm, yeah. Unfortunately, insurance companies love Texas. And they get away with way too much here. That's one of the drawbacks of living here. But, you know, you can't have everything. I'll discuss more of this here in just a second. Let me play Houston. Houston is many things. It's diverse, progressive, economically thriving, and entirely affordable. It's the next great world city. Houston is one of the most exciting cities in the Texaplex. What is the Texaplex? It's the triangular region of Texas that comprises Houston, Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, and Austin. It's where 80% of the 24 million Texans live. Houston's position in the Texaplex is built on key benefits that the city enjoys. We call each of these a Texaplex advantage. Houston's first Texaplex advantage, its size. With a growing population of 5.7 million, the Houston metro area alone has more residents than 32 states. It's the largest city in the southern United States and the fourth largest overall. Throughout the 20th century, Houston was the fastest growing city in the nation, and by the year 2030, the population will grow another 30%. There's plenty of room for all this growth. The 600 square miles that make up the city of Houston could contain the cities of New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, Minneapolis, and Miami. The real Texaplex advantage of Houston's size is its economy. If Houston were an independent nation, and don't think we haven't considered it, it would rank as the world's 30th largest economy. This massive population and economy support the 6th largest airport system in the world, serving more than 51 million passengers each year. The city's public transportation system operates more than 1,400 accessible buses and a 7.5-mile rail line. It also boasts the nation's 3rd largest fleet of taxis. Follow a taxi on a Monday morning and you may see a passenger dropped off at any one of the 29 Fortune 500 companies that call Houston home. Which brings us to Houston's next Texaplex advantage. Business. Second only to New York City in the number of Fortune 500 companies, Houston is also home to 16 of the Fortune 100 fastest growing companies. Last year, Houston was the number one city for job creation in the nation. Look at the accolades. Biz Journals ranked the top 10 labor markets in the nation and put Houston at number one. Forbes.com named Houston as one of the top 10 up-and-coming tech cities. The Center for Women's Business Research named Houston the fastest-growing metropolitan area for women-owned businesses. And the list goes on. Seems like everybody's in on the secret. The Texaplex advantage is real, and Houston is taking full advantage of it.
which may explain why the Texas Medical Center in Houston is the largest medical center complex in the world. 5 million patients each year visit the center, which boasts over 20 million square feet of space and employs more than 50,000 people. The MD Anderson Cancer Center is U.S. News & World Report's number one cancer treatment facility in the U.S. With the local economic impact already at $10 billion, the expanding healthcare economy will likely be a boon for the center and the city. Just next to the Texas Medical Center stands Reliant Center, one of two convention centers in Houston that together comprise nearly 2.5 million square feet of meeting space for conventions and education. This is in addition to the more than 60 colleges, universities, and other degree-granting institutions that call Houston home. There's 360,000 students enrolled at these institutions, and many of them will likely stick around after finishing their degrees, since Forbes ranks Houston first on the list of best cities for college graduates. With more than 5,000 energy-related firms, Houston is known by many as the energy capital of the world. But it's not all just big oil. Houston's focus on energy has resulted in a progressive, modern approach to energy creation. 32% of the city's electricity load is purchased from wind energy. The EPA's Green Power Partnership named Houston the number one municipal purchaser of green power in the nation. This is just an example of another Texaflex advantage Houston possesses: a progressive attitude. Houston's progressive attitude may have something to do with the fact that the city is home to the nation's third largest concentration of consular offices, representing 86 countries. More than 90 languages are spoken throughout the Houston area, revealing the city population's various ethnic and religious backgrounds, as well as a growing international community. Houston is the fourth largest city in the United States, and with the election of Mayor Anise Parker, it is the largest city with a female mayor. By now, you're probably thinking that Houston sounds like a great place to live. You'd be right. That's part of the Texaflex advantage. The weather is warm. It drops below freezing only 18 days a year. All this sunshine means you can work on your golf game 365 days a year at one of more than 165 public and private golf courses. Golf isn't the only sport you'll find in Houston. Houston has a professional team in just about every sport. But if sports isn't your thing, there's still plenty to do. Houston's 17-block theater district is second only to New York City. Home to 8 performing arts organizations with more than 12,000 seats, Houston offers world-class year-round entertainment in all major performing arts. If you'd rather spend more time outdoors, you'll be happy to know that Houston ranks first among the nation's most populous cities in total acreage of parkland. Boat enthusiasts find plenty to love in Houston as well. Located 50 miles from the Gulf of Mexico and just 30 minutes from the 2,000-acre Clear Lake destination, it's no wonder Houston has the third largest pleasure boat basin in the United States. After a full day enjoying all Houston has to offer, you can really work up an appetite. Fortunately, you're in the right place to eat. ForbesTraveler.com named Houston one of the best restaurant cities in America. And Houstonians agree. They eat out more than residents of any other city from a selection of more than 10,000 restaurants. With such an array of entertainment and lifestyle opportunities, it may surprise you to learn how affordable Houston is. Houston's overall after-taxes living costs are 12% below the national average. Its housing costs alone are 26% below the average. This bang for the buck you get from living in Houston probably explains why Houston ranked first on Forbes' list of best cities to buy a home. In fact, Kiplinger's Personal Finance recognized Houston as the number one city to live and work in the entire United States, based on its strong economy, abundant jobs, reasonable living costs, and all the fun things to do. Houston is a city of incredible opportunity, where great things continue to happen. As the energy capital of the world, with the largest medical center, one of the largest ports, the sixth largest airport system and the second largest concentration of Fortune 500 companies, Houston provides incomparable employment opportunities in nearly all the major growth industries: energy, healthcare, engineering, transportation, and science. It's a diverse and progressive city with an unstoppable economy. Its highly diversified industrial sectors, thriving economy, and low inflation give Houstonians a high standard of living. Of course, the food and entertainment options certainly help. All this adds up to one giant Texaplex advantage. Houston is a city of infinite possibilities.
Okay, well, there's a lot of information there. Where to begin? Well, first of all, I'd like to say there's a link on the show description page, and this is just Texas in general. There's probably about 20 videos on a series that's called The Best of Texas, and it's for all over the state and various topics, you know. Where is the best place to buy a steak? Where is the best swimming hole, the best hiking, the best park, where is the best barbecue, and it's all rated on people voting here locally on where the best is. And there's also video, of course, of all of these places, and you can get a glimpse of what Texas actually looks like, in many places anyway. You don't get to see all of it. Texas is pretty large. So, but anyway, first thing I wanted to mention here, you know, they discussed the convenience store 7-Eleven. Now, I remember when I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, we got our first 7-Eleven here in Houston. They used to sell shotgun shells, and you could, that was back when TVs were tubes instead of transistors. And but your set went out, you take all your tubes out of your set, go down to 7-Eleven, plug them into this machine and test them. And if you needed a new tube, you could buy a replacement tube, go home, put all the tubes back in. But anyway, ironically, 7-Eleven left Houston in the very late 70s. All the one locations here got bought out. So there are no 7-Elevens in Houston. I'm sure there are in Dallas. But anyway, something I wanted to mention too, you know, it said there was no state income tax. Well, we do have a sales tax like everybody else. Our sales tax is probably a little bit higher. However, that is because we don't have a state income tax. So at least you get to choose whether to spend your money or not. It's not forced on you. And as far as non-prepared food goes, there is no tax on non-prepared food. I know a lot of places tax everything. But food here is considered to be an essential for survival, and the idea of putting a tax on it is preposterous. Now, if you get prepared food, like at a restaurant, or if it's processed or packaged, then yes, there is a tax on that. So, but anyway, let's see here. What was the next item? The population of Houston, the metro area, has definitely gone up since then. It's more like about 6.2 million. And I think Dallas, Fort Worth has actually slowed down a little bit, and Houston is kind of catching up. But Dallas, Fort Worth, you know, there's two cities. Each downtown is about 30 miles apart from each other. And they sort of grew together and formed one metropolitan area. At one time, they had a common radio market, a separate television market. But that's not the same anymore. And the size of Houston they were talking about, yes, that's about right. Houston is the largest city in the country in square miles, except where you have situations where the county and the city are the same. For example, Jacksonville, Florida. If you go to Jacksonville, the county and the city are pretty much the same entity. Hold on, I got to clear my throat. So, and Houston is larger in square miles than Los Angeles is. Also, too, something about Austin. You know, they don't do one on Austin, or at least I haven't found one yet. Austin is becoming the next Silicon Valley. It has been for a while. I think AMD has been in Austin for a while, and Gateway Computers is in Austin, if I remember correctly. But all of these companies in California are moving here because the cost of doing business is just too high there. It's just ridiculous. So that's something to keep in mind if you're a techie. Now, they mentioned the Houston Medical Center. Well, the Houston Medical Center got itself on the map for two particular reasons. Heart surgery, heart transplants, and I think we were the first one in the nation to have a helicopter emergency service. So if you have a car accident, you know, then they bring the helicopter out there and put you on a stretcher and put you in the helicopter, take you to the hospital. The medical center is larger than downtown Dallas in area. It's huge. I was born in the medical center. It's been there for a pretty good while. They mentioned the first shopping mall was covered in Dallas. Now, what they mean by that, I'm not quite sure. I guess it's just a covered walkway between shops. But the first air-conditioned mall was in Houston, and it's the Houston Galleria, and that was sometime in the early 70s, I believe. And let's see here. They were talking about food in general. Well, yes, both cities are rated on the top on restaurants and food. And, you know, I saw this piece on New York where they were criticizing Texas and saying, oh, we got this, oh, we got that. Well, they ain't been to Texas. We got just about everything they got, maybe more. You know, there may be one or two things we don't have, but... You know, you want Russian food, you can get it. You want Vietnamese food, you can get it. You want Chinese, you can get it. You know, if you want exotic meats, if you ever had buffalo steak, you want buffalo, you want kangaroo, well, there's a place here to get it. So the fajita craze began in Houston, just like the margarita craze began in Dallas. And so, I remember one time, before I forget, my stepmother was talking to my father, and we were going somewhere, I don't know, in the car, and I was in the back seat, and she was saying that some guy had hired on that came down here from New York, and he was just totally blown away because he was expecting to see nothing. He was expecting Houston to be nothing but a bunch of ranches. You know, and I mean, that's just, you know, there's fucking Jews in Hollywood for you. You know, it's just total bullshit. Let's see here. It said Dallas is the largest inland port. Well, I guess that pretty much means air freight. And Dallas has two airports, DFW and Love Field. And Love is the oldest one. I've been to both of them. And then there's two airports in Houston. There's Intercontinental and International. And I've been to both of those. And most cities don't have two major airports. Now, they mentioned, too, that... Houston being a port city. Well, Houston is number one in foreign tonnage just about every year. New York is second. And every once in a while, New Orleans passes up Houston in total tonnage, but never in foreign tonnage. Usually it's New York and Houston, and Houston is always first in international tonnage. Yeah, there's only about 18 days where it gets below freezing, and that's usually only for a few hours. It's usually only right before dawn and maybe another hour or so after sunrise, and rarely does it stay freezing past 10 a.m. And Houston also has the largest livestock show and rodeo in the world as well. You know, they were talking about how there's all these consulate offices here in Houston, and everybody knows of Eric in Texas. Well, he's been to Russia a couple of times since he's lived here in Texas, and I had to go to the Russian consulate here in Houston to take care of his visa for him. I was surprised they didn't have one in Dallas, but apparently they all like to be in Houston. But Houston is probably more of an international city, and that's probably why. And, of course, that's not necessarily a good thing. Let me light this cigarette. But so be it. That's the way it is. And, of course, Dallas with its airport there, it's a hub for most of the region. It's just geography. You know, they were talking about how DFW might be, you know, 9 million at some point. Now, of course, that would be more than New York City itself, not in its metropolitan area, of course. But, you know, that would be all spread out. And like I said, Dallas-Fort Worth, the downtowns are about 30 miles apart. And Houston, you know, like I mentioned on it, the square miles, it in one direction it's about a little over 35 miles, and the other one it's probably about 45 miles. So, I mean, it takes that long to get from one end to the other. Let's see here what else is on the list here. One of the big differences between Houston and Dallas is there's a couple of, you know, a couple of significant ones. Dallas is completely surrounded by suburbs. It can only grow up. Now, of course, the metropolitan area can keep going, growing out. But, you know, Dallas might would be a larger city by now had it not been for all of the suburbs around it, whereas Houston only has one major suburb. You know, it's got like the Woodlands and Pasadena, and then it's got some smaller ones. And the rest of them are fairly small in comparison, but Houston swallowed up most of its suburbs. I mean, there's some eight suburbs that they were at the edge of town at one point that have been completely surrounded by the city of Houston. In fact, those suburbs don't even have their own mailing addresses anymore. I mean, they're still cities, but their zip codes are all Houston. So if you send somebody a letter that lives there, you don't put the actual city name they live in. You put Houston on there. And the other main issue between the two cities is Dallas is zoned, Houston is not. Houston is the largest city in the country that is not zoned. And we look at it as the fact that that's beneficial for business. So, you know, however, there are plenty of suburbs to live in here. A lot of them are not incorporated. Some of them are, some of them aren't, but I believe that pretty much covers everything I have on this list here, and I'm going to get into some more of the specific demographics on the next show. And what I'm going to do for the rest of this show here is I'm going to play an old documentary, probably done somewhere in the late 50s or early 60s. It gives you a little bit of a brief history on Texas and the United States expansion in that area, and then after that I'm going to get into some other issues. I think I'm just going to wait till I play this and let you hear it, and then discuss the rest of that then. And again, this is a little bit old, but it gives you a little bit of basic history, and at this point it's probably good to have just this basic streamlined history, and then I'll get into the more specifics later on. And you know, what you've heard so far is it's been fairly specific, but it's been written by others that were in this movement. And the rest of the stuff that I'm going to read is from general history books that some are a little politically correct, some are not. But I'm not going to read you anything that isn't factual, put it that way. And so what I'm going to do here, we've gotten about an hour into the show so far. I guess I'm going to play a song first, and then I'm going to come back to this, because I just got through looking at the clock. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play some Pantera, who are from Dallas. They're going to do a cover of a Black Sabbath song.
You better
Okay, I'm back. This next is about 20 minutes long. It's just a little brief history piece. It's good to hear at this point because it starts to give you a little bit bigger picture. And as this series moves along, and believe me, there's still a lot to talk about. It would be hard to say exactly how many more shows this could wind up being. It could wind up being 25 shows total, that many at least, maybe more. There's that much to go over. And, of course, it'll cover more than just what you need to know, but I'm going to get into some pretty specific stuff, especially with the history and the relationship to Mexico, because that's very important. And that's what you need to know, because you're going to be confronted as time goes on with bigger and bigger lies against us, and you need to be armed with the facts. So anyway, let me go ahead and get this started, and I'll be right back. Forgot there's a little silence at the beginning. I don't spend time fixing these. Too much time.
The year is 1821. In Missouri, a 28-year-old American prepares to leave the United States to make his home in northern Mexico. Stephen Austin is his name. In Tennessee, another 28-year-old American practices law and prepares to enter politics. He is Samuel Houston. At Veracruz, New Spain, a 27-year-old army captain leads a revolutionary force against the Spanish government. With his help, Mexico will soon be an independent nation. He is Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. Austin the settler, Houston the lawyer, and Santa Anna the soldier. All three will be important in the history of Texas. Texas that Stephen Austin entered in 1821 was the northernmost part of New Spain. It was larger than Texas is today. When Spaniards first explored and settled the region 2 centuries earlier, it was larger yet, extending northward into land that would become Wyoming. To Spaniards, the word Texas meant peaceful people. But Spaniards found little peace there. Apaches, Comanches, and Wichitas resisted Spanish efforts to dominate them and convert them to Catholicism. With guns and ammunition from the French in Louisiana, they fought the Spaniards. But Spaniards stayed in Texas. Among them, the wealthy owners of haciendas, huge estates granted by the Spanish king. Gentlemen cowboys or charros became heroes, dressed in ornamented costumes. They were skilled in horsemanship and roping. In the early 1800s, charros and Spanish settlers lived inland and in south central Texas. But the Spanish population was small. The largest town, San Antonio, had only 800 people. The Gulf Coast was nearly unpopulated. To maintain their hold on the land, the leaders of New Spain looked for Spanish Catholic settlers. Stephen Austin's father, Moses Austin, had met one of those qualifications. He had traveled in Spanish territory and claimed Spanish citizenship. agreeing that his settlers would become Spanish citizens and would convert to Catholicism, Austin petitioned the Mexican government for permission to settle 300 American families in Texas. He submitted his plan to the Spanish governor of Texas in San Antonio. Then he died, leaving his son Stephen to carry on. In September 1821, Stephen Austin chose and mapped a huge tract near Texas' southeast coast. And a few months later, he led an advance party overland from New Orleans. Austin's settlers were farmers from nearby Louisiana, Mississippi, and Missouri. They bought land from Austin for 12.5 cents per acre, 10% of the price of United States land. To get to their land, Austin and his settlers traveled a rutted trail connecting Natchitoches, Louisiana, with Nacogdoches, Texas. It was called El Camino Real, the Royal Road, and it was in such bad condition that Austin had sent most of his supplies by ship, a ship that landed in the wrong place, then was wrecked. The supplies were lost, so the first American settlers in Texas survived the winter by hunting. In the spring, as more people arrived, Stephen Austin faced another problem. A revolution had broken out in New Spain. Mexico had become an independent nation. There was a new government whose leaders did not recognize Austin's right to own land. To secure his claim, Austin traveled to Mexico City, 1,200 miles away. When he arrived, he worked for a year, meeting influential people. Finally, Stephen Austin received what he had come for, the right to occupy and sell land and to govern a colony, according to Mexican law. Shortly after Austin founded his colony, Mexico's leaders ruled that Texas should be joined to its neighboring state, Coahuila. They allowed the state to select others who would distribute the land as Austin had. These men were called empresarios. Some empresarios failed to recruit settlers, and their land was taken back by the Mexican government. Others found settlers, but Indian attacks and financial troubles caused them to fail. A few got along badly with the government. In 1825, an empresario named Hayden Edwards began bullying and evicting people who had lived on the land before he came. When Mexican officials objected, Edwards led 30 of his colonists into the town of Nacogdoches. It was a revolution, he said, and he named himself leader of a new Texan nation. Austin and the Mexican army opposed Edwards. They marched into Nacogdoches, and Edwards fled to the United States. Most Americans in Texas were from the South, where slavery existed. It was illegal to own slaves in Mexico, but slave owners worked out a scheme in which they freed their slaves but asked each one to pay his or her own value. Having no money, the slaves became servants for life. So slave owners kept their slaves. Americans continued to migrate. The population of Texas grew until in 1830, there were more than 20,000 Americans there. United States government under President Andrew Jackson offered to buy Texas land to extend the U.S. border into Texas. Mexico's leader, Anastasio Bustamante, said no. and he appointed a tough military commander for Texas, Don Manuel Mier y Terán. Terán advised his government that Mexican border guards should stop American immigrants, that goods from the United States should be taxed, that all Texans should be forced to worship as Catholics. In 1832, Terán fortified the border and moved in troops. Texans became concerned. Their concern grew when Terán picked Colonel John Bradburn, a Mexican-American, to command the town of Galveston. Bradburn arrested settlers and tried them in military courts. To Texans, this was intolerable. But another revolution had begun in Mexico, with a leader who seemed to be promising democratic rights and freedoms to all Mexicans, including Texans. That leader was Antonio López de Santa Anna. After fighting in Veracruz, Santa Anna had become a general and a governor. Now he was opposing Bustamante. Texans were delighted. Stephen Austin wrote, "Santa Anna asks nothing for himself, but all for his country." Santa Anna's revolt succeeded. He became president. Texans gathered and decided to ask for favors, like the right to receive U.S. goods without paying import taxes, and permission for more Americans to settle in Texas. To word these requests, conventions were held in San Felipe and Nacogdoches. Sam Houston was there. He had been a fighter in the Tennessee militia and governor of Tennessee. At the Nacogdoches convention, Houston helped to write a petition asking the Santa Anna government for rights and freedoms. Stephen Austin carried that petition to Mexico City and was told that Americans would again be permitted to settle in Texas. But Santa Anna would not separate Texas from Coahuila. He would not remove army posts and military governors like Bradburn. Angered by these refusals, Austin wrote, "The country is lost if its inhabitants do not take its affairs into their own hands." For this statement, Stephen Austin was jailed for 3 months. Santa Anna was even more unjust than Bustamante. The breaking point came in 1835, when the Mexican army arrested two businessmen who had been complaining about high import taxes. A crowd gathered outside the courthouse. They attacked a Mexican messenger carrying military orders. Reading them, Texans learned that they were about to lose their rights and freedoms. The Mexican army would take charge of Texas. Angered by these orders, 25 Texans, led by a young lawyer named William Travis, fired a single harmless cannon shot over the Mexican post at Anaheim. Travis wrote a letter of apology, but Mexico's commander, Martin de Cos, was unmoved. He ordered the Texans to arrest Travis and try him for treason. They refused, and Cos marched 1,400 troops into Texas. Austin said, "War is our only recourse." Other Texans agreed with him. At the town of Gonzales, when Mexican troops came to take a cannon from Texans, they were greeted by 160 armed men and a sign reading, "Come and take it." The soldiers advanced. The settlers defended themselves. And that was the start of the Texas Revolution. From fall 1835 through spring 1836, Texans fought Mexican troops. At first, they fought for rights and freedoms as Mexicans. There was Houston, who became commander of the Army of Texas. There together with a frontier adventurer named James Bowie. There was Davy Crockett, who had been a congressman from Tennessee. There was Moses Levy, chief surgeon of the Texas Army, who laid down his bandages and fought at San Antonio. There was Edward Burleson, an Indian fighter who stopped the attack of Cos. Several of these men fought and died in February 1836, when Santa Anna led 5,500 Mexican soldiers against 183 Texans at an old mission armory, the Alamo. When Santa Anna killed the Alamo's defenders, Texans agreed. They were no longer fighting for civil rights, but for independence. Only 6 weeks after the Alamo fell, they surprised Santa Anna at San Jacinto. Sam Houston was wounded, but the Texans won. The Mexicans were defeated. Santa Anna was captured, dressed as a civilian, trying to escape. Suddenly, Texas was no longer a part of Mexico, but neither was it a part of the United States. In April 1836, the leaders of Texas declared their land an independent nation. And Texas remained independent for nearly 10 years. Though Mexican armies continued to invade, though Indians continued to attack, though Texas did not have the population, industry, or finances needed to stand alone. Sam Houston became president of Texas. He offered certificates for free land. Over 100,000 people accepted the offer. Though most of the new Texans were Americans from the southern states, many came from Europe, from France, England, and Sweden. Many came from Germany, where emigration societies recruited settlers. A German, Prince Karl of Solms-Braunfels, brought over 400 settlers to Texas. He went bankrupt. A Jewish Frenchman, Henri Castro, surveyed and mapped Texas land. He built a European settlement in southwestern Texas. But Castro failed to provide for his people. He lost his land. All that remained of the developers was the names of their towns. Throughout Texas, people had abundant land, but they lived without conveniences, without good postal service and roads. Their army was the militia, volunteers who frequently went home to work their family farms. The Texas Rangers defended settlers against Indians. But there were only 200 rangers in all of Texas. Indians continued to attack, especially Comanches, who clearly saw that Texans were taking their land. Because Texans wanted the U.S. government to defend them, they voted to apply for annexation to the United States. But most members of the U.S. Congress were against annexation. They voted no to avoid helping Mexican rebels and because many objected to slavery in Texas. So Texans survived on their own for 10 years until, in 1845, the pressure for annexation became stronger. Congress voted to accept the Texans' petition, and Texas joined the United States. Texas, the land entered by Stephen Austin. The land that Santa Anna tried to preserve as a part of Mexico. The land that Samuel Houston fought for and won. Texas had become the 28th state.
Okay, I'm back. That was kind of funny, wasn't it? Like I said, that was done sometime probably in the probably early to mid 60s, maybe not the 50s, but it could have been. But it of course it was pretty hokey, but it was an amazing 20 minutes of history. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill in all those blanks for you, and you'll have a far better understanding of it when we're done with this series. What I'm going to do next, I want to discuss the current Texas national movement a little bit. There is a nationalist movement here in Texas, and it, however, it's the politically correct version of the word nationalism, as you would find in, say, the Tea Party, etc. But it is mostly whites. You'll find a token Mexican or a token black here and there, but you're certainly not going to have many Mexicans because most Mexicans want to bring the state back into Mexico. And most of your blacks, there's a few blacks in the Patriot Movement. There's some who understand that, you know, where their bread is buttered, but, you know, there's not many. It's mainly white. And there's probably even a Jew or two in there as well. But they are far more serious than the Patriot Movement is. Far more serious than the Patriot Movement. The Patriot Movement, you know, they'll just... not the Patriot Movement, I'm sorry. Far more serious than, say, the Tea Party Movement. Probably as serious as the Patriot Movement. In fact, more serious, in the sense that they actually believe in taking some sort of action. You know, they will get up and they will go out in public and present themselves. And you'll see them at gun shows here. You know, you'll see them in front of the state capitol. You know, no one at the capitol really gives them a problem anymore. They used to, but not now. But Eric has met the guy who led the movement. But he gets the impression that the guy could be a Fed. But let me put it to you this way. Let's say the guy is a Fed. He's still very knowledgeable about Texas history. Very knowledgeable, and he's very well spoken. And I am going to play a recording of him coming up. But the people may not realize that they're being led, if that's the case, but they are still serious. And even if this guy were removed and you propped up somebody real, they would be behind him just as much, if not more. Now, the average white person here in Texas who is from Texas is very nationalistic. Okay, and this is not Rick Perry talking about shooting coyotes or whatever the hell he said he was going to do. Rick Perry is a scalawag. He's just a paid shill. But, you know, we here in Texas do take our separation from the United States very seriously. And this is not the same secessionist movement that everybody heard of, where there was this petition on the president's website. That was just a way to collect names. This is completely separate from that. And you'll understand here shortly. And I want to bring this up now because it's real important, because that's part of the reason I'm doing this. Now, my thoughts are this. If Texas were to exert its power and reclaim its own status as a sovereign country, I guarantee you all the illegals here would head back to Mexico. And if it looked like it was going to be predominantly white and redneck, well, I can guarantee you most of these blacks that are here are going to skedaddle on back to Georgia or New Orleans or Mississippi. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, they can just have Georgia, make themselves the capital in Atlanta. It's probably the best place for them. So anyway, the point being here, by the way, most of the blacks in Texas are pretty much, you take a line from Houston to Dallas along Interstate 45, most of them are east of that. There are a few in central Texas, like south of Dallas, you know, that are moved a little farther west than that. Used to, there was no blacks in San Antonio whatsoever. There are some now. There are some moving there. San Antonio is a boom town right now. San Antonio is booming more than Houston or Dallas is. And it's oil and gas. There's a huge, I think, there's a guy that was on Kyle's social network who has worked in some of these down there. And Eric works for a company that does business in that area. And Eric is to and from the San Antonio area all the time from where he lives. So anyway, what I want to do now, though, is just introduce you a little bit to this. Now, the next show that I'm going to do, I'm going to read some actual Texas history written by someone here in Texas at the time that it was actually happening, before the Texas Revolution. He wrote a little small booklet, and I could probably read it in about an hour or so. That will give you a lot of detail and better understanding of what this was all about down here. And again, from the words of someone who actually lived here during that time, which pretty much invalidates all the political correct crap that you're told today or taught in school. Now, there are some things that are taught that are accurate for sure, but it's presented in a more politically correct manner and gives more favor to Mexico, and ultimately it leads you to believe that the United States just stole the land, and that isn't the case. Not at all. So anyway, the first thing I'm going to play is a news report from the local NBC affiliate here in Houston on this Texas National Movement. It's only about 3 minutes. And then I'm going to play another song after that. And then I'm going to play a documentary done by the guy who is in charge of this current movement. And it's a streamlined history, but it's longer than 20 minutes, and it's not hokey. Okay? You'll gain a lot from it. But first, the news report.
Turns out that one group of Texans who were watching tonight's State of the Union address wish they were watching it from another country without having to move. They want our state to secede from the Union. And tonight, Local 2 Investigate goes inside the Texas nationalist movement. Could they really be a political power? Local 2 Investigator Joel Eisenbaum discovers why they're pushing for you to have a choice.
It may be a cold, rainy morning at the state capitol in Austin, but one by one they come with flags and signs and megaphones.
The federal government has overreached, overstepped their bounds.
I think secession is the only option.
Welcome to a rally for the Texas Nationalist Movement. Their mission, turn Texas into its own country.
Because you stand for liberation.
Those here say they're not part of any militia, no plans to storm the capitol. But they say the federal government is sending the country and Texas on a self-destructive course, and they want out. The solution, they say, is a peaceful transition to an independent Texas.
You live in a country that is falling apart.
Daniel Miller is the group's president.
Our focus is the political, cultural, and economic independence of Texas.
Miller, a business owner in Nederland, is pushing for a bill that would give you a chance to vote on secession from the United States. The group's been around in some form for 20 years, but Miller thinks now may be their best shot.
The administration in Washington, D.C. does the majority of the convincing for us. Every time those guys make a move, our membership grows.
The Texas Nationalist Movement claims to have 250,000 members. Right now, there are more than 110,000 likes on the group's Facebook page. That's more than the Texas Democratic and Republican parties combined. Miller says the group's polling shows several Texas counties are 65% in favor of secession. And he's telling lawmakers that Texas nationalists now have voting power that can make a difference.
I think is a fair warning to them, enough to skew an election result.
But there's a big reality check.
They're a bunch of clowns. They have absolutely no basis for what they're saying.
Peter Linzer is a constitutional law professor at the University of Houston Law Center. Legally, he says, the Supreme Court has ruled no state can leave the Union. Linzer believes the group is made up of political poor sports who can't accept that they're losing the national political game.
These people don't want to be Americans anymore. I don't think they like being told that. It ain't going to happen.
Texas nationalists we talked to say they believe they'd win any legal battle. Some lawmakers have told us they're also frustrated with the federal government, but not one of them has proposed a bill to put secession up for a vote. Joel Eisenbaum, KPRC, Local 2.
By the way, Texas nationalists did not start that now famous White House petition asking for Texas to secede. They have their own petition. It focuses on convincing state lawmakers.
Okay, I'm back. So they have made the local news in the fourth largest city of the country. That's more than any other nationalist movement that I know of. No one is talking about the neo-Confederates. Nobody is talking about any racialist movement unless it's something negative, et cetera, et cetera. I think you get the picture. Now, this Jew lawyer they had from the University of Houston there, yes, there's Texas versus white. If you heard my discussion on the 14th Amendment, then you know a little bit about it already. They took a case that had nothing to do with secession and turned it into such. However, if you really look at it, and I'll get to the details of that at some point, Texas is not really technically, according to the Constitution, a state in the Union. It did become annexed and voted to be annexed, but it does not meet the constitutional requirements of a state. Neither does the state of West Virginia, and my understanding, Nevada. And I'm not going to get into Nevada or West Virginia, but West Virginia is worth hearing because it seceded from Virginia and became part of the United States during the war between the states. It seceded from Virginia, which was part of the Confederacy. Ironic how they accepted West Virginia as seceding from Virginia, but they wouldn't accept the Confederacy seceding from the United States. And of course, where did the United States come from? It seceded from Britain. So anyway, what I'm going to do here, I was looking at the clock and looking at the time of this one that I was wanting to play here, It's called A Not-So-Brief History of Texas Independence. But it's an hour and 24 minutes. And it's already less than, well, it's about 25 minutes or so, 28, 27 minutes till the end of the live broadcast portion of the show. And so that that would be putting it right at about the end, I guess. So I'm going to go ahead and play a quick song. And then instead of playing that, I'm going to play another documentary. And these are the same people, by the way. But it talks about some of the things that they're doing. And these, again, these are the same people that I was going to play this other one on. I'll hold off on that one until the next show. And again, these people are not like us. They're not aware of the Jew problem. And some of them actually think Ron Paul is legit, but he's not. But these people are still far more serious than any Tea Partiers. That's for sure. Okay? And that does not change anything. But they do have a better understanding of history. There are a couple of minor errors in here from what I remember. One of them was an issue of how, of flying the state flag as high as the U.S. flag. Well, all states can do that. There's some myths that have that go around here, but Texas does in general have more rights than other states. For example, it owns all of its public lands, contrary to all the rest of the states in the United States. The only land the United States owns in Texas is what it purchased from Texas. It takes from the other states without necessarily paying for it. So, and Texas also has rights out into the Gulf of Mexico that other states do not have. And I will go over a court case with everyone on that as well. That's a rather interesting court case. It happened in the 1950s. It was the largest issue regarding states' rights in the 20th century. And Texas won, and it did go to the Supreme Court. So anyway, I'm going to play this other one here. Let me scroll down here back to where I was at. And let me find it here. Tell you what I'm going to do here is I'm going to play a song and then I'm going to play that. So I'll find it while I'm playing this song.
Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. Cause I speak of the pompous of love. People talk about me, baby. Say I'm doing you wrong, doing you wrong. Well, don't you worry, baby, don't worry. Cause I'm right here, right here, right here, right here at home. Cause I'm a picker, I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner. I play my music in the sun. I'm a joker, I'm a smoker, I'm a midnight toker. I get my loving on the run.
Bye.
I'm a smoker, I'm a midnight toker. I sure don't want to hurt no one.
Okay, that was Steve Miller, and as I mentioned in the first part of the show, his primary years of school and his youth, most of his youth, were here in Texas. He grew up in the Dallas area. I'm going to go ahead and play this documentary. This is going to run past the 2 hour mark if you're listening live, and I know there's a few who are. I just checked, and you can call in right before the into the show. It's a Keep Hearing if you want to do that, or else you can download it and catch all of it at a later point. It's up to you. And any errors or things that need to be clarified, I'll do it after this documentary is over with, and then I'll end the show with the song, and we'll do part four afterwards. So we'll go ahead on and proceed with this.
Regarding what the Republic of Texas was, in 1836, a number of people who had moved here from North America, at the invitation of the Mexican government to settle here, they were being chased out by a new president of Mexico who was also a general of the armies there. And they had to defend themselves against Santa Anna and his armies. That lasted for about a year. But finally, General Sam Houston, leading these volunteers, defeated Santa Anna at a place called San Jacinto. And in defeating the President and General of Mexico, they were able to force him to sign a treaty. The treaty formed a new nation. It said that he would never again come across the Rio Grande River to bother the people in Texas anymore. The treaty also said that the land of Texas belonged to the people who lived on the land of Texas forever. And that's a treaty that is perpetual. It doesn't go away. So what is the Republic of Texas now? It is the land of Texas. The land of Texas does not belong to the U.S. It doesn't belong to the federal government. It belongs to the people who live here. And there is no federal land. If they want land in Texas, they have to lease it from us for their military bases and so on.
Okay, going hot.
Off the hip. What the Republic of Texas is today, in the early 2000s, a number of people got together and said, you know what, if the land is still ours, and if there's a perpetual treaty that says we are a nation, let's just be a nation. And so they elected, but with a vote from the people, a president, vice president, secretary of state, a Congress, a Supreme Court, justice, and all of those are still occupied and manned to this day. In fact, that government meets every month on the second Saturday of the month, and the people of Texas who are interested come to those meetings. That's what it is today. The purpose, the goal of the Republic of Texas and what we're doing is to restore and to preserve all the freedoms and all the sovereign rights that were won in 1836 at the Battle of San Jacinto when that treaty was signed. In other words, we're here to make sure that the people get to exercise those rights, even though an overreaching federal government of the U.S. keeps trying to take away more and more of the rights and freedoms. We're here to restore them and to make sure they're preserved.
Motion. Do I have a second?
Wayne Williams, Brazoria County, I second.
I drove here from Lake Jackson, Texas. It's about 240 miles. I had to wake up early, but I wanted to come. I went last month to this meeting, and what I see are some people that are concerned about where our country's heading, and they look for the alternative. There's a lot of talk about secession in this country because we see tyranny in Washington. We see even our own elected representatives wind up getting elected because they're people with wealth that are paying for their elections.
Anderson. One I just talked to.
No, Marianne's in the back.
I told her I was going to leave this for Mr. Patterson.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. He's not here. He's not here on Friday afternoon, right? She asked me, said, "Well, if you was him, would you be here on Friday afternoon?" I don't know about that. I left the act passed by Congress to reclaim all the land of Texas and get it on record. We reclaiming all the land for the people.
This is a map of the original boundaries from 1836 of the nation called the Republic of Texas. Here's a map of the state of Texas today. And all of the mountains, all the way up to here, which is Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Kansas, and Oklahoma, that were part of the nation then, have been stripped away because this is the northern limit of Texas, which is somewhere in here.
I think I'm going to make a stop here before we leave the building.
I've served these papers to all the different governors, to the Washington, D.C., to the Bureau of Land Management. So what I'm doing is I'm leaving him a copy because I didn't serve him a copy. I just served all the top people.
Do you have any money, real money? Yeah, would you?
Sure. Hold your hands off.
I might want to buy some real money. Okay. So this is...
That's copper, pure copper.
This is copper?
That has a face value of 2, you'll see on the other side.
Okay.
99.9% pure silver. That one's in a airtight, so it won't tarnish.
Yeah. How much is this worth? What, $35? Oh,
that one goes for about $35.
Okay. Can I get a couple of these things from you?
Sure. I help design these. I draw them first, and then have an artist you know.
Oh, okay, cool.
Why don't you just give me 40 and the eggs and the chicken on side.
Okay. Great. Well, I'll be glad to do that.
Then we're bartering.
That's fine. I like that. I like that. I like that.
Machine that's running Republic of Texas currency. Right now we've got it set up for a 1 ounce 39 millimeter silver medallion in a fruit finish, and so you can see the Republic of Texas star on one side with an outline of the original Texas surf map, and on the other side one nation under one god with a great sculpt of the Alamo there. We started doing these all the way back in 2009. We've made hundreds of thousands of pieces of this so far. So these presses were used by the U.S. Mint in Denver for almost 50 years to make pennies. And now what we're going to do here at the Mulligan Mint is repurpose them to make fractional silver and a complementary currency system that we can use to change the world. Well, we believe very strongly here that money is the root of all good. And so if we can put the control and issuance of money back in the hands of the people where it belongs, that anything is possible. We can level the playing field. We can make a marketplace that once again is fair and open to anybody that wants to get in, anybody that wants to be creative, make something, create value. And money is the way we keep track of who owes who what, how we exchange value in the marketplace. If the money's not fair, if the money's not honest, then it makes it impossible to have fair exchanges in that marketplace. And so what we're going to do here is we're creating that complementary currency system that can fill in the blanks where the U.S. dollar lets us down, and we can reestablish honest marketplaces where people can barter and trade once again.
It's my suggestion. Says, give me a suggestion, so there's my suggestion.
There's your suggestion.
We're the only one that has a land office out of all 50 states.
If the 49 other states, all of their land records are not in their state. The land records for all 49 states are up in Virginia, very close to the District of Columbia.
Bureau of Land Management. United States Bureau of Land Management. The United States owns, has full control of all that other,
okay,
all the other states.
Yeah, on their records. These records stayed in Texas because we're still independent. Then the U.S. Senate ratified a treaty with Texas for friendship, commerce, and navigation in 1843, but refused to ratify a treaty of annexation a year later in 1844. That December, outgoing President John Tyler proposed that Texas be annexed by a joint resolution of the U.S. Congress. That passed in February of 45, and in November, Texas voters approved annexation.
In 1861, the people discovered the United States wasn't going to do what they said they was going to do. So they elected, formed another, a new constitution, and took another vote whether to secede or not. The United States declared the vote and the constitution null and void. But what the people didn't understand is Texas never ceded its lands, and they were taking a vote to secede, and you cannot secede from something you never ceded.
Jane's a mighty hutter. Anybody after her chickens?
Yeah.
Man, they're dead. You don't go after Jane's chickens.
Janae's right on where I needed to drop them at.
Okay. Oh, dead on.
Do the next one. Got to fire off another one. Do both of them. Do all three of them. Just bam, bam, bam.
All three of them.
There's another one.
Perfect. Perfect.
Okay, y'all happy now?
Yes.
The kind of governments we have now are like a parasite. A parasite is a living thing, but it lives off of the lives of others. There are parasites on cows. There are parasites on trees. Government has become a parasite. And there are as many people dependent on the government in the United States as there are that are not dependent on the government. So it's a kind of a 50-50 deal. Well, we can't support that other half by our labor because government doesn't produce anything of value. It only takes what's of value and gives it to people who work for the government or who are dependent on it. In the Republic of Texas, that can't happen. The Constitution of the Republic says the government is very small, does very few things, is forbidden to do the other things, and so people keep the fruits of their labor, they keep the work of their hands, and then they can start businesses, they can hire more people, the other people have jobs, everything works fine without the parasite.
Download the official RT application to your cell phone. Choose your language, stream quality, and enjoy your favorites from RT.
If you're away from your television, well, it just doesn't matter. Now with your mobile device, you can watch RT anytime, anywhere.
Of Moscow.
I think right now, the way things are going, the Republic of Texas would be a whole lot better off than the state of Texas. Texas has got its own electrical grid. It's got all the oil and gas and everything it needs. It's got all the industry and everything it needs. It can survive by itself without the rest of the United States, which is to say the rest of the United States cannot survive without Texas, from my understanding.
Most people around this country or around the whole world are thinking oil wells when they hear about Texas. Well, that was true a long time ago. But now, 2013, there is more energy coming out of the ground from natural gas than there is from liquid petroleum. And there's enough natural gas discovered already to fuel Texas for the next 100 years or longer. This plant behind us is one of the plants that's capable of burning gas. Yeah, because there is so much gas and oil and coal and wind and solar available in Texas, meaning we have a lot more sunny days, Texas is a standalone area as far as energy resources. It does not need to import energy from other states or from the federal government. It can export energy, and so the resources are here, and the cost of energy per BTU or per whatever you measure it is usually, almost always, lower in Texas than it is in the rest of the states, which is very good for us. But that's because with the independent Texas power grid, Texas does not have to let the U.S. regulate the cost, the price of energy. The people who work at the Mint are not employees, they're partners. And they've agreed that when they get paid for their work, that they will be paid in silver that is produced at the Mint. And it makes sense because they're producing real money and they want to be paid in real money. Everything is barter. They're exchanging their labor, hours of their life, for a commodity, and that commodity is silver. It's like paying people in eggs or bacon. Since they're being paid in a commodity, according to the U.S. government and the IRS, this is not money, this is a commodity. So since they're not being paid in U.S. dollars, and they aren't, then U.S. dollars are what's taxed. That's the simplest way to put it. There's no income tax if you're paid in eggs or if you're paid in loaves of bread. You know, that's just an exchange. A commodity for the use of my time and my skills.
Sir Evelyn de Rothschild, and he is sitting there overlooking all of his sheep hanging out in front of FEMA camps and the IRS and the Federal Reserve and the Bilderbergs and the CFRs. We are the nanny state now, where we are being watched almost everywhere we go by security cameras and satellites and drones flying over us. We've got our military now to extend democracy out there into the rest of the world, and as long as we're asleep and we're just watching TV, everything's going to be just fine. Every once in a while they lose one of us, and they don't really like to lose us, but it's all collateral damage. The people here believe very strongly in peace. We're pacifists. We are anti-war. We believe at the same time, though, that very strong defense and being able to protect your life, your liberty, and your property is also very important. So as we walk through here, you may see guns scattered across the building. There's a AR-15 back here in this corner. It belongs to our marketing director, Trey. And so you'll see a lot of people carrying and doing things that most normal businesses wouldn't normally do.
It has the Second Amendment actually on the back of the coin, completely spelled out. It's one of our more popular medallions.
I think this poster here really sums up who we are better than anything else in this building. Ron Paul is certainly one of our personal heroes and probably the by far the most legitimate person that's ever served in government. He wrote a book called End the Fed, and it's a great book, but we took a little bit of a different approach and said, why don't we just stop the revolution and start the evolution and ignore the Fed? Instead of trying to compete against them, instead of trying to put them out of business or wave a sign and get them to change what they're doing, let's just ignore them, pretend as if they don't exist, and we'll watch the effect that they have over our lives and our finances disappear almost to nothing. So we like to ignore the Fed around here.
You know, people often ask, what would it take for us to have the authority to govern
the land area and the people of Texas. And there are several possibilities or probabilities that would bring that about. One is a complete economic collapse when the monetary system of the United States stops working. And it's inevitable that it will. And then you have anarchy, then you have chaos, then you have disorder. And the thing that's needed is to have a government in place that works on a volunteer basis instead of having to be paid huge salaries as the people in Austin, Texas are.
That's John. That's why you see him up there hanging.
Where do you want to start at?
Here. The news articles are starting to reveal what we've known for a long time here, and that is that there are more jobs in Texas than just about any place else. And in fact, Governor Perry has said Texas is open for business, which is another way of saying we have jobs here, and we do. And the question is, why does Texas have plenty of jobs when there are whole states that just can't create jobs and have so many people, more people going on unemployment than ever? And there are several reasons for that. One is a lot more Texas people are personally entrepreneurs. They think in terms of how can I organize people together to provide a product or provide a service which people want. In other words, not to get them to want something, but if they already want something, how can I provide it to them? You know, the biggest part of it is there's just a whole lot less government interference, over-regulation. You have to get a permit. You have to wait 6 months or a year before you do something while they go and think about whether it's good for the people or not. If it isn't good for the people won't buy the darn thing. That's it, you know.
The United States flag and the Texas flag flies at the same height. We're the only state, and we're the republic, that can do that. The other flags have to fly below. And whatever is on top of that, the finial that's on top of that flag, sets precedent. If it's a ball, it's a military flag. If it's an eagle, it's a presidential flag. And one of these days, I'm going to slip up there and put a McDonald's hamburger on top of that American flag.
Okay, let's go to the Capitol. See that statue up yonder? It's 2 feet higher than Washington, D.C. statue. Everything in Texas is bigger. Okay? Always. We got our own land, we got our own flags, we got our own money, and we got a Capitol building higher than Washington, D.C. That ain't bad.
Texas was fighting, that is, defending itself against the armies of Santa Anna from Mexico. They chose the gold star as their emblem and says Republic of Texas. And that seal was adopted in 1837 and is still in the Capitol building today, right here in the very center of the building. Which is just another evidence that the Republic of Texas has not gone away. There's just a different form of government governing it. But the land, the people, and the culture, and the spirit of Texas are still the same today.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
As an elected senator in the Texas Republic, I've had to give thought to whether I even wanted to run for that office. And during all of that, I decided that it was worth doing for several reasons. I have children and grandchildren, and I guess pretty soon I'll have great-grandchildren. And I want them to grow up and live in a place that's truly free, and that requires a nation that's independent, where the government is limited. It's limited in the amount of money it can spend, or borrow, or print, or coin, or whatever. So I saw a chance for me to play a part of having a clear vision, putting it in words, putting it on paper, and creating the base, the foundation on which a free nation could live again. A free, independent Texas.
Okay, I'm back. I guess you could tell that was an RT documentary. I probably could have clipped that commercial there out, but I just don't have time to sit there and do this to every audio file that I deal with, and I've been dealing with a lot of them lately. Something else I wanted to mention, you know, they talked about the Capitol being 2 feet taller than the United States Capitol is. The dome on the U.S. Capitol is larger than the dome on the Texas Capitol, but the Texas Capitol is taller, just like the San Jacinto Monument is taller than the Washington Monument. I'll go over more of details of the Texas Capitol building in the future. It was built, I think, in the 1880s, the current one, and when it was built, it was the largest building in the world in square footage. Certainly not anymore. I think the Pentagon has that title currently, unless something has changed. The floor in the rotunda of the Capitol building, if I remember correctly, that's the location. On the floor, it says Republic of Texas. And this was in the late 1800s, well after the war between the states. Also, too, the Capitol building in Texas is 4 stories high. The U.S. Capitol is only 2 stories in most places, and the Texas Capitol has actually had additional buildings added onto it, additional areas added onto it, rather. So it's even larger than it was when it was built. Now, something you should ask yourself, name any other place in this country where people are doing something like this. Well, there is a secessionist movement in other places. You know, Northern California wants to secede. Vermont wants to secede. Hawaii wants to secede. Alaska wants to secede. You know, but you got to ask yourself, who's further along? And, of course, you got to have 3 things for a sovereign country. You have to have people, you have to have your own money, and you have to have borders. The United States does not have its own money. It does not have any borders anymore. And take a look at the people. So there you have it. More on this later. We'll pick this up next week, hopefully, maybe even before then. We'll see how it goes. I have a lot on the agenda of things to do here in one way, shape, or form on other topics and other shows. And so I hope everybody enjoyed this tonight. And next week, again, I'll read from what I was talking about earlier, where someone had written brief history from the time before right before the actual revolution in Texas. And then I will play that hour and 20-minute clip, or hour 25 minutes, I believe is what it is, clip on Texas history presented by the same man who is currently leading the Texas nationalist movement. One thing I did want to mention, you heard in that Channel 2 news piece earlier that the number of signatures, or no, not number of signatures, but the number of likes on their Facebook page at that time, that was probably accurate. There's close to 175,000 likes on there now. And of course, some of those people are not from Texas, of course, but you'd be surprised at how many people who are aware of this movement, who would say, if y'all can do that, I'll move there. So, you know, you can consider what's going on in South or North Dakota with somebody that is just going to wind up getting you in trouble when it's all said and done. Or you can look down to towards Texas, where people actually know what freedom is all about and have a track record of it throughout their history. It's in their blood. And I'll get to that as well next week. Keep in mind, the people in the Texas Revolution was the next generation after the American Revolution. So it was like their parents had fought the American Revolution. So anyway, a whole hell of a lot more to come. So I'm going to go ahead and close out here with some Dixie Chicks. Three of the original five members were from Texas. They originally formed in Dallas. They have had some members change. I don't know what their status is currently. I think there's three of them now, but three of the original five were from Texas. But and I don't even know if they're still Dallas-based. But nevertheless, here are the Dixie Chicks, and we'll see you on the next show on this series. Hope everybody enjoyed it. Thank you for listening.
If we keep running, you will lose your army.
Twenty-odd years ago, Napoleon returns from exile in Elba, puts together an army and moves east, swiftly, before an alliance of nations can occur. Wellington, with fewer men, fewer armaments, stays one step ahead of the French, teasing them with his presence, knowing that a large army will have to splinter to keep up. He moves and waits. Moves and waits for Napoleon to make a mistake, to fall into a scenario that condemns him to defeat. Wellington chooses a setting for victory. Before it exists for him, before he lays eyes on it, it has an open battleground, a sloping plain, cover for encampment, and an opportunity to flank the enemy. The Mexican army is splintered. And though they do not know it, Santa Anna's troops subsist on gasps of air and sips of hope. I share Wellington's battleground vision, though I do not know the name of the place that I imagine. I, sir, do not consider myself Wellington. Santa Anna, however, does consider himself to be the Napoleon of the West. We shall move and wait until he makes a mistake and presents us with his own Waterloo.